Welcome to Near Death Experience Podcast. I'm Chaz Hathaway. Today we're going to share the experience of one of our listeners, Jim Bruton, who shared his experience by emailing neardeathexperiencepodcast@gmail.com. And today we're going to share that experience. He says, "Hi, Chaz. I'm enjoying listening to your podcast. A little over 2 years ago, I was in a plane crash and nearly died. I broke all of my ribs, ruptured both lungs. My right leg was so broken that I now have more metal in the leg below the knee than meat, I believe. My skin on my chin was in shreds and hanging down, making speech impossible, and a small battery broke loose behind me. And as my small plane went from 70 miles per hour to zero in about 10 feet, became a projectile, creating a hole in my lower back, causing patterns of numbness below my waist and throughout my right damaged leg. At some point, I also suffered respiratory failure. Once I was helicoptered to the major hospital's trauma center, the surgical team took me in and got to work right away. They had to restrain me as a precaution, as I had many life-saving tubes stuck into my body and was placed in a breathing machine also. I was delirious and have no memory of this or 2 days prior. I've gone back in my emails to finally find a timestamp I remember the text of. As a result, I didn't recognize my daughter sitting next to me and tried to make friends with her in order that she remove one of my restraints, canvas-like bags around my hands, cinched tightly around my wrists. When she refused, I somehow managed to get my right hand out anyway. She called for help, the medical team put me in stronger restraints, and then told my wife with the multiple 6+ hour operations coming up, that it would be best to put me into a coma. That's where my near-death experience begins, which I have attached as a PDF. Word for word, it is also on a webpage I created, www.inbetweenproductions.com. The talk I'm sharing with you was given before a local IONS group here in CT back in July. The reason the website was productions in it has productions in it is that I'm working with a screenwriter to incorporate the experience and what follows into a script for television or film. Either of those are a long shot, even for the best stories and those well connected, but I'm not worried about the end result. I just feel compelled to share my experience one way or the other. In my subsequent research, I have discovered my near-death experience to be fairly different from others. I know they are all unique to the individual, but absent from mine are many of the usual experiences. Tunnel, beautiful landscape, or terrifying one. Meeting good or evil spirits, or long-lost loved ones. Past life review. A barrier which can't be placed, or can't be passed, or one stays dead, etc. The place I went to, I know to call the in-between. As time is measured here, I was there for 1 week, yet it was less than a second, which I knew to be or to call the impossible now, which I knew to call the impossible now. Maybe this is what Planck time is, 10 to the minus 44 seconds. It was neither pleasant or frightening. I wondered if it was purgatory from the post-apocalyptic imagery, but came to realize it wasn't. I saw no one else, appeared there suddenly, and left just as quickly, and felt no love or fear. I would say I felt no real emotion whatsoever, which I believe was acquiescence. I felt no joy or fear, but I did feel solely a sense of purpose. I came to know that I wasn't there to feel good, but had my mission. That was to remove the choices in my future that are to my spiritual detriment. I was not able to see them, but had to feel for them with my hands. If they were bad, they increased a sense of stomach nausea I felt upon arrival to this plane of creation. I wonder if it is because this place was a little farther away than most, more objectified and objectifying, depersonalizing in that the earth plane was further away and without reference. I had no memory of anything here. Who else I might have been than this disembodied spirit or anyone who might miss me? If asked whether I wanted to go back or stay, I would have answered, go back where? That's how in the present I was, and honestly, still adrift as an after effect of the near-death experience. While I didn't see anyone there, I wasn't alone, and my talk contains a conversation I had with a disembodied voice telepathically there. I came back still in touch with the IB, the in-between, and what was said there was said in such a way that I was aware of how much more wasn't said, as if the silence between the words contained more information than unfolds out of it once I returned here, and so it has. On my website, there is another page, Thoughts and Reflections, which contain much of that. I hope I've piqued your curiosity to read my story, and if it is of interest, to include it in one of your podcasts. If you do, please just let me know so I can listen and can let others know. If you have any questions or want to talk by phone, please reach out to me and I'll help. One thing that has recently fascinated me is PMH Atwater's research on near-death experiences, specifically her own use of the words in between and the eternal now in comparison to my impossible now. She describes a specific type of NDW, creating what's called a colloidal condition as a result of a car or plane crash, and describes the in-between in ways my own experience confirms. Honestly, that was pretty amazing to have a one-of-a-kind experience like this, and then hear someone describe it down to the wording you were given on the other side. She and I are in email contact now, and I hope to meet her in the near future. Thank you for reading all of this and your efforts with your podcast. Here is what the in-between looked like to me. All the best, Jim Bruton. Now, Jim includes an image here, which I will include in the show notes. And we also have a PDF that I'm going to read from that he shares. And this may go a little bit long, but no, it's not too terribly long, but we'll go ahead and see how it goes. Jim Bruton says, first, I will begin my story using the present perfect tense, as if it's happening right now. And before I read this, I do want to say, lest you're feeling a little bit put off by the strange terms in between and you know the eternal now and things like that, because I know some people may start saying, "Wait, what are they talking about?" You got to understand that there are no words for what people are experiencing on the other side. And the only chance we have of ever being able to communicate these things is to come up with words or terms or things that give something of a package that we can, you know, an explanation within an explanation within an explanation, so that we can actually use words to explain these near-death experiences. So if you hear strange terms, or at least terms that may sound strange to you, be patient with them, because this is an effort and a necessary effort to come up with words and terms and meanings for things that just don't have words or terms or meanings for. And so using these terms and trying to, you know, kind of assimilate them into language is how we're going to be able to communicate what's happening in a near-death experience. And so, you know, I wanted to say that before we got too far into this. But so Jim Bruton says, first, I will begin my story by using the present perfect tense as if it's happening right now. It reminds me that the place I experienced isn't a place you go to or come from. It's simply a place you are. As you allow me to share my near-death experience with you, I hope you will take it in with both your logic and your feelings. Logic tells us what should be correct, and emotions tell us what is important. If either ear you listen with gives you rise to voice, I hope you'll share it with me. As I begin, one thing I'd like to share is an observation. Generally, people who have near-death experiences aren't trying to sell anything other than perhaps a seminar, a book, or a DVD. We don't try to sell a new religion because we left all that behind. However, spirituality plays a pretty strong role in the experiences we share. One of the strangest things I've noticed is that for those of us who have had our near-death experiences as a result of some horrific event, while in most cases the accident and its crazy circumstances would be the focus of any compelling story, a near-death experience negates that. Once a near-death experience enters the picture, you almost forget about the accident. It becomes the least important part of the story next to the near-death experience. My accident was amazing as accidents go, and I have a near-death experience friend who is only one in a handful in the world that she knows of who has suffered and survived an internal decapitation. But to near-death experiencers, the circumstances that nearly or do kill us are just a footnote. I'm sure that must be surprising in some way. Okay, first a bit about me, and this will bring us to the near-death experience. Dreams of childhood. My life is one of fulfilled childhood dreams. I watched a weekly natural history program called Wild Kingdom every Sunday night. I think, how do I do this for a living, traveling the world, filming animals? I read popular mechanics magazines, hoping the next science fiction gizmo will wind up in my garage. I think, how do I live in a science fiction future today? I love the 1966 film Magnificent Men in their flying machines. I think, where are those unique airplanes and how would I fly one? Dreams of Africa. I meet a girl in college whose father makes wildlife films. After dating a few months, I ask her if her dad ever needs help. She asks, and he says, yes. I lived and worked in Africa off and on for 14 years. I also had my own safari business. In time, I will win an Emmy for my work in National Geographic Television. Dreams of the future. I'm filming an African sunset over the ocean when I see my first satellite telephone. Synchronicity. Disney. House of the Future in 1969 in Namibia, 1993. I ask if anyone has ever sent video over it. No one has. So I figure out how to do it, forever changing field production for news agencies around the world. As a lecturer at Yale University of Medicine and a NASA principal investigator, I integrated my satellite system, medical devices you wear, a swallow, which were destined for the International Space Station, and led an expedition twice to Mount Everest to test them. I was even able to design a satellite tracking system with an accuracy of 1.5 degrees, a finger's width, when you extend your arm, over 22,500 miles. Dreams of adventure. My work eventually takes me to all seven continents, the Titanic, the North Pole, and Mount Everest. Add to that a bunch of war zones where I'm able to perform two studies as a war journalist for NBC News, etc., and as an independent contractor helping our military and government, meaning I wasn't there and it didn't happen. Dreams of flight. Eventually, I grow tired of being a professional nomad and come to CT, where I meet and marry a widow with three babies. Understanding that I might feel a little restless, my new wife asks, why don't you build an airplane, build that airplane you're always talking about? So I do. The Fokker flies well, and I set it to an Air Force pilot, and I sell it to an Air Force pilot. However, I don't like the way the flying flea flies on its first test flight. But being a pretty good pilot, I decide to take it up again and figure out its quirks. It's Thursday, October 6th, 2016, in late afternoon. I take off my, make a low pass over airfield and continue around again. Halfway back, my engine stops. I am north of Waterbury, near my grass airstrip, but can't make it back for an emergency landing. There are only forested hills all around and around me, and no safe place to put down. The only target to consider is a small pond with a nearby Boy Scout camp, so I aim for it. I start my engine one more time, but it's too late to pull up. I make it to the water pond, but overshoot the bank and hit the trees just 10 feet in from the edge of the water. Within 10 feet, the trees bring me to a stop from 60 or 70 miles per hour, ripping my wings off and splintering my wooden airplane into 1,000 pieces. I still can't fathom why my engine, mounted right in front of my face, didn't hit me square on. When my plane stops crashing, there is none of it left around me, only the portion behind my seat to which I am seatbelted. Ouch. Fortunately, a man is nearby fishing, sees the whole thing, and quickly comes to my aid. He calls 911 on his cell phone and describes my situation, propping me up as instructed by the dispatcher until the LifeStar helicopter can arrive. The result of the crash leaves me with all of my ribs broken, my lungs ruptured, a right leg resembling a pretzel, my chin torn up, and a hole in my lower back, possibly from a small battery breaking loose and becoming a projectile. The helicopter crew lands as close as possible and quickly removes me from the wreckage. After stabilizing me as best they can, they fly me to Hartford's trauma center. When my wife and kids arrive at the hospital, they find me in a breathing machine with tubes going into and coming out of my body in every imaginable way. I'm delirious with physical shock, pain medication, and recognizing no one or able to understand my circumstances. In fact, I have no memory to this day of these events, my crash, or 2 days prior. In my bed, my hands are strapped inside these canvas-type bags to prevent me from pulling out any of the life-saving tubes, but even with these restraints strapped around my wrist, I'm able to get free in my attempt to escape. My oldest daughter sees what is happening and calls for help, and again, I'm immobilized. The surgeons speak to my wife and suggest that with my days of multiple 6+ hours operations ahead, they will put me into a coma for the duration. She agrees, and so they do. As I go to sleep in this world, I awake in another. I appear in this otherworldly place to find myself resting on one knee, high up on a terraced rooftop of an abandoned building. I'm bent over in stomach pain and with great effort look up. I see an amazing panoramic skyline of a purgatorial city. Gray buildings stacked upon gray buildings stretched all the way back to a brooding skyline. Apocalyptic clouds hover over the metropolis, storm heavy. In this gothic world, there are no sounds. I'm not deaf, it's just that quiet. Kneeling in its shadow all along, I suddenly notice to my left the only real thing of interest, a large egg-shaped structure formed of open latticework with many gears inside, monolithic, austere, and finely crafted. The egg is maybe 4 stories high, its intricate lattice constructed of a dull metal as gray as the world surrounding it. Another wave of nausea hits me. I say out loud, I don't think I can stand this. Inside the egg, there is an immediate whirring of sector gears, the kind of partial arc gears you see in clock-like mechanisms. These move in all directions within the confines of the egg. With great effort, I draw closer, studying the egg and its moving gears within. What follows is a conversation that was telepathic and a characterization of what was communicated. Me. What is this thing? As I stand before the mighty mechanism, a disembodied voice responds within my consciousness. This is the future birthing into the now. I see the gears, some of which appear solid and some not, passing through each other in a physically impossible manner. The otherworldly dance of the gears is complex, like a four-dimensional model of time. They come to rest, and I reach through the gap in the side of the egg. This is the process of becoming. My fingers brush one of the more solid appearing gears. As I touch it, within my mind, I see something like a video feed of future events. Then I double over in pain. With a reflex, I rip the gear out, pulling it through the egg's lattice wall and throw it over my shoulder. The machine responds by spinning its gears around again, recalibrating for the loss of one, whispering with a light clacking sound into a new configuration. What's happening now? Each gear is the probability of a thought, word, or action in your future. Your destiny is resetting itself around what you have removed. How did I know I could do that? Pull that gear out, remove that future moment. Why else are you here? I have no idea. I don't even know what this place is. You are in the in-between. In-between what? Everything. The impossible now between the past and the future. That makes no sense whatsoever. It's impossible in its short duration. Yet here you are, standing inside the eternity of a single moment. Do you remember who you are in the world to which your body belongs? I look blankly into space, squinting with the effort to remember. I have no idea. Then you see the truth in how the past is dust. Okay, why do some of these gears, these futures that I touch, make me sick and not others? All choices have unintended consequences, some unfortunate and some not. The pain each brings is your guide. The pain each brings is your guide. Where are the gears that feel good? You're not here to feel good. More gears emerge within, some passing through others, several clear and definite, many less defined and hard to focus on, though all bringing with them their clear images of meaning. Each time they come to rest, I pull out a gear that I feel by my pain to be my future detriment. A new gear swings into view. On this one, I see a Ferris wheel and happy grandchildren whizzing by, fingers grasping their car, laughter. They smile at me or through me, looking off into their own world. Obviously, I let that gear pass by. At one point, I looked at the growing pile of gears. It's starting to look like if I don't have a bad future, then I have no future at all. Even though I now feel less pain, I'm going to die sooner from doing all this. Am I going to die sooner from doing all this? Your destiny has to fit itself around futures that aren't meant to be. Your number of breaths are already counted. I will worry about your last one. I don't know how comforting that is. Eliminating bad choices doesn't mean you won't make wrong ones. You won't know they are wrong until after they pass. Since right and wrong are variables you have no control over, the answers to what comes tomorrow are a waste. Better is understanding the beauty of how everything fits and refits together. So what am I missing here in my lack of understanding? What is clearly before you? Grace. No one deserves heaven. It can only be given by grace. It's your birthright, but it must be chosen at the expense of the world that separates us. This fixing my future is painful, and I feel ashamed that I'm not doing it with some moral compass. I'm only guided by pain. I don't even know where or when these futures happen. Where is no more important than what or when. Removing your enthusiasm to further chain yourself to the world isn't as painful as carrying the crushing weight of those chains once forged around you. It's as if this place was made so I can only do one thing or one thing only with no chance to screw it up. If those with choices make poor use of them, then offering fewer possibilities could be called mercy. I watch a gear disintegrate into dust as it passes out of view from the present into the past. You can't change the past, but you can make better choices in the future. Everything is interconnected, and pay more attention to your relationships. Be gentle with everyone, as I am gentle with you. Gentle? What's gentle about all this? You prayed for someone for which being here is the answer. And now the man who fell from the sky is not the same who flew up into it. I look up into the stone gray sky and then out across the seemingly dead and abandoned city. I look back to the egg and reaching up place my hand upon it. And I say aloud, I think I can live with this one. That's when I wake up on this physical plane of existence and find out later that I was away for 1 week. I can tell you that I did not stop the entire time while in the in-between, yanking out those gears in order to feel less sick. But time doesn't seem to move at all there, and it's not like I had a physical body that needed rest or to eat or sleep. I find it interesting that I speak out aloud only twice while there, once upon arrival, and then when I leave. I say that second sentence because it becomes torture to watch the machine's gears spin around and over it in readjustment to my changing future. At a high level, this overview represents the story of my near-death experience. However, it continues to unfold in me and offers new insights on a daily basis. In comparison to more commonly experienced near-death experiences, mine differs in these ways. Tunnel. I do not experience the traveling down a tunnel to the other side. Rather, I just appear in the in-between, meeting loved ones or anyone else. I see not one other being there. However, I know I'm not alone. Past life review. I do not have a life review like that usually reported. However, in comparing what I believe may have represented one, it makes me ask as to its purpose, where it might be the same function, if not in form, in that the gears I can see are the most probable emerging events within the egg representing my future. I believe these to be the fruit of my past and my pain, some measure of that as well, from a spiritual perspective. However, in that we can't do anything about our past, my attention is directed to a different atonement, to simply take the net balance of my past as pain, in which to guide future decisions to be better ones. And that provides the means to remove those things in my future, those probabilities, for which I may be tempted to partake, even if they are attractive to an as yet unknown propensity of my mind, a feeling of unconditional love. Again, in contrast to this, I compare the in-between to a military boot camp, where there is no feeling of love per se, neither is there from your drill instructor, but the purpose is to help you survive what comes next, to strengthen your resolve to push on, and to create not courage, but heart. that and to make better informed decisions to ensure your survival and success. Boundary of no return. I don't see one. I don't think it's meant that I should see or have one, or to have that option. When I am in the in-between, I have absolutely no memory of my life here or anyone in it. If someone comes to me and asks if I want to go back or go on, I have no idea what they mean. I am lost in the infinitude of a single moment, the impossible now. I wonder why no gear. Even those representations I can see as positive makes me feel good. At best, they simply feel normal. Perhaps it is that right should be, perhaps it is that right should feel normal, and I am more focused on the process of setting things up to be right than experiencing the content of right living. I mean, you can build a pool without ever getting wet. Similarly, I was speaking to Jack about these things like synchronicity and other things that seem magical when they occur, and I asked him if he'd noticed that when such things happen and others are present, that there is seldom a wow, but rather an acceptance that suggests that it is a normal thing. I have seen this many times, but never anyone exclaim, "This is incredible and impossible." A few additional thoughts I want to share. One friend asked me if I had a premonition that day to not fly. Before my crash, I would have simply considered that with test flying, any experimental aircraft, there is always a measure of concern. But after my near-death experience, that question triggers a different thought. It is actually a question for all of us to consider. And that is, if I had known that the plane would crash, would I have had the guts to still get in the cockpit? Think about it. If God needs to get our attention and is ready to put aside a week for you, one-to-one, what price is too great to pay? If I had known this, I honestly doubt I would have done it. But I know what the answer should be. Perhaps for now, that is enough. As I revisit the in-between, I learn more about my experience in studying at a consumer level quantum physics than returning to my study of mysticism and spirituality. Those gears of possible futures flowing ghost-like through each other are what quantum physics calls the superpositioning of probabilities within an emerging event. From those simultaneous weaves of possibilities, eventually one will collapse to become a particle of reality. We may not be able to control them, but we can ride along with them, like feeling the power of the ocean as we surf its waves. I mentioned that some of the gears were less in focus than others. Now I understand that you can't focus on a probability because it is a representation of several possibilities, which aren't yet in a single place to be focused on. Until one supersedes the others and becomes the singular present. It seems a poetic statement that the housing of all the gears birthing from the future to the present appears in the shape of an egg. The in-between is showing the quantum reality of time, entanglement, and how things are interconnected. Obviously, this is more to its purpose than this. But obviously there is more to its purpose than this, but it's amazing how logically consistent this model is the deeper I dig into it. There are entangled things that are a universe apart, and when you change that state of one, you instantly change the state of its entangled mate, no matter the distance in space or even in time. There are things that happened at the beginning of time that are not will affecting other things at the end of time. Literally, in between the two is only the present. As we travel along the arrow from one to the other, are we not traveling only toward an end, but also back to the source in that the two are entangled? Taking it a step further, if something is happening at the beginning of time that is also happening at its end, then everything in between must be happening all at once. Time is the artificial construct by which the story plays out, with a beginning, middle, and end. Does each possible probability spawn its own moment in time, with its own future, allowing every possibility to play out? Some paths of science and mysticism say yes. Earlier, I mentioned learning that understanding is more important than answers. That understanding provides meaning, and the answers provide purpose. They both go hand in hand, but some things' purpose needs what is not for definition, whereas understanding does not. That's because understanding doesn't judge. Purpose, defined by answers directing its motion, has to. We know good because we avoid the bad. When I was moving the gears, representing bad choices in my future, I said that I wasn't guided by a moral compass or holy scripture. I was guided by the pain of my choices, past and future. In removing them, I have no idea what they were, nor do I need to. They hurt me, so I got rid of them. The questions and answers of what they were replaced by the understanding of what they were simply, understanding that they were simply bad for me. As the in-between said, it doesn't mean I won't still make wrong choices, but at least there's a chance now that they won't be bad ones. And if you still think answers are more important than understanding, I'd ask you to consider how that worked out for Adam and Eve when they traded the fruit of understanding and meaning in the Garden of Eden for that of answers and purpose in the world. Even John Milton, an English professor or philosopher in the 1600s, an author of Paradise Lost, said that the highest form of God is that which is not yet manifest. Synchronicity. I recently made friends with someone in New York who has taken an interest in my story. About 2 weeks after we met, he sent me a photo from near his office of an egg-shaped sculpture, or metal sculpture, that greatly resembled the egg I saw in the in-between. An amazing resemblance, made more so based on the timing. A couple of weeks later, I received an invitation from another friend to go to New York for a luncheon whose topic was kindness. Authors, screenwriters, actors, and others there who were articulating their amazing experiences of receiving, more than giving, kindness. I looked up the location of the venue and discovered the egg-shaped sculpture was directly outside the building. So I was able to visit it. Of all the possible places my luncheon could be, it was right there, and appropriately so, given the subject. There is one other synchronicity that is mind-blowing. Remember I said that the wildlife show I watched on TV was followed by an hour of Disney? Well, thinking back on my time on the other side, I find it interesting that within 1 week, experience with two endpoints defined by amnesia, physical shock, daily 6-hour doses of anesthesia, and intense painkillers, that I could be rational, capable of thought, and remember with great clarity. My summary. The egg shape of the machine housing the gears of my future represents the continual birth, perpetual becoming. 2. Within this egg, the gears represent my most probable thoughts, words, and deeds as the incubating embryo of my future, impregnated by my choices and destiny, moment by moment determining and determined by who I am at this instant in time. 3. I am given the opportunity to gene edit the DNA of my future and re-engineer the events and experiences that will bring out of me a better person. 4. Working on the fundamental, internally latent level results in changes in this outwardly manifest level we call life. And 5. Because the latent is too large to be held by the manifest, that which is oblivious in one place can only be intuited in the other. Logic alone fails because it perceives only what is correct. But emotions tell us what is important. Putting down the roots of faith and connect to logic with the bridge of intuition. This is how the two appear to work together, at least for me. And all of this happened in what may have been a split second in the present of the in-between while my body aged 1 week. I would like to say one more thing. With all the force of will you need is found the art of letting go. Always live life in celebration of the individual spirit. For no one, no thing, can stand before the brilliance of the truly naked soul. And that is the end of his PDF where he shares his experience. That's Jim Bruton. And again, his website that he shared is inbetweenproductions.com. Very, very interesting. First off, I'm fascinated by the visual imagery that he saw in his experience. First off, it was not a joyful place, per se. It was not a place where he feels this grand love, but rather it's this place of kind of, like he says, in between. There's a quietness about it that's almost, I don't want to use the word haunting, but it's kind of this quietness that speaks volumes. Let's just put it that way. And this egg-shaped device with gears and so forth is very interesting to me because I have heard of several near-death experiences where there is some kind of steampunk aspect to it. Now, I don't know if that's really the proper word for it, but in fiction, steampunk is the idea of old-style machinery in a futuristic sort of setting. Another example of this was an experience where someone was standing on the earth and there was this great revolving door, kind of, you know, not a revolving door, it was like, I'm picturing this kind of a revolving disc sort of thing with these, I don't know, doors of various realities representing different possible outcomes of different things, and it's very gear-like and, you know, clock-like and so forth. And so, you know, that aspect of it is not completely strange or out of sync with near-death experiences that I've heard. But this is a very unique near-death experience. There is not the tunnel. There is not the love. There is not this glorious light that is drawing Jim in. But there is this experience of reworking his future based on who he is today. And normally, I say to people, you know, believe their experience happened, but take their interpretations of it with a grain of salt. But as I hear Jim's interpretation of his experience, I mean, it's incredible. It's more than I would have been able to draw out of it, or more than most philosophers would have been able to draw out of it. And who better than the experiencer to provide that incredible insight that Jim gives about for his future, in the sense of future decisions that he would make that would bring him suffering, that would be detriment to his soul. And I would say, like he did, that this was probably an even more effective thing for him in terms of life review. You know, many will have a life review and see, oh man, I haven't done the things that I came here to do, or man, I want to be a better person, and so they'll change their life and be better, or put their focus on more important things and so forth. But for Jim, it was more like, as things would happen, or as he would come across the different gears that are taking place in this egg, he would feel pain towards some, and he would remove those ones that would bring pain. And so this is, I think, a good one to read at about this time. Because we've read a lot of experiences where everything was just like, no judgment, just joy, love. That, you know, and I'm not trying to make fun of that or trying to look down upon it. That's incredibly meaningful and useful and so forth. But it helps to remember sometimes from these experiences that, you know, yes, there is love. Yes, there is light. Yes, there is someone who is fully on your side. But don't forget that this life is about choices. This life is about making something of yourself. And that's going to look different for different people. It may, for some, it may involve, a life of giving and a life of you know, reaching out to others or volunteering for service-oriented organizations. For others, it's going to mean get their life in order, you know, break certain relationships that are hurting them. And for others, it'll mean, you know, get out of this hole that you're in. And others, it may just mean, you know what, you're really not trying very hard. Why don't you give it a little more go, a little more oomph? And, what it comes down to, I guess, is the point that I'm making is our choices. And whatever situation we are in, if it is not where we feel like it should be, if our spirit is not resonating with our life as it is, then it is up to us as individuals to make the choices to tear out the choices of the future that are hurting us or that will hurt us. Because as he says, the past is the past. It's you can't change that. But what you can change is the choices you make in the future. And I kind of get a little bit, I don't want to say annoyed, because I don't get annoyed at them, but I want to kind of, you know, go up and talk to the people, shake them and say, wait a minute, when somebody says, well, I never had a chance. My family was terrible to me growing up. I had terrible relationships. They would do these terrible things to me, and it hurt and it ruined me. And I don't deny, and it's not my place to judge or even to say, you know, that they had anything to do with that, because I don't want to suggest that in the least bit. They have no fault for being survivors of abuse or any kind of anything that people have done to them. But the point that I want to shake into them is that, yes, you've been through these things, and yes, you've hurt. You've been hurt, and you don't need to deny that. But you have a choice as to what kind of relationships you have in the future. You have a choice as to who you associate with now. You have a choice as to what kind of parent you're going to be, assuming that you have the opportunity to be a parent. You may say, I never had a chance to see what a good parent was. Well, you cannot make the excuse that there's no way for you to find out what a good parent would be like. The resources are just too abundant to find out what good parenting should look like. And it's not going to be perfect. You're not going to be a perfect parent. That's not what I'm trying to suggest. But what I'm trying to suggest is that you can make a better life with your future than you have had in your past. And yes, there are things in your past that make that more difficult. If you experience anxiety or suffering or post-traumatic stress or anything as a result of your past, that will be a difficult thing to work through. But it is not impossible. It is not impossible. There's nothing about your future that says you are doomed, because you're still here. You're on this earth. There are things that you're going to experience that will be painful. There's no question about that. But it is up to you to decide the level of what you're going to make of your life from this point on. And I can tell you, it is tempting to look at a painful loop that you may find yourself in and say, I'm powerless to do anything about this. That's understandable that you would feel that way, but it is a lie. And it is a lie that you've told yourself so many times that you can't seem to see your way through it. And it may require help in order to break away the mask that is blocking your vision of all the potential futures that you have. But it is in your power to do it. So don't let anybody ever convince you that you are powerless to do anything about your future. If you are blind, you may be powerless to get vision back, but you are not powerless to make something of your life. One of my best friends in the world is one of the greatest people I know, has done so much good. He's a teacher and he's a parent, and he's when I talk to him, he might as well be a philosopher for all the incredible thoughts that he has, both about spirituality, about religion, about just life in general. I mean, and yet he's been blind from birth. He's had that as a suffering point for his whole life. And I know it hurts. I know it does. But he doesn't let that define the quality of his future. He makes something of himself. And that's just one example. I know of people who are paraplegic or even quadriplegic who have done incredible things with their lives. Yes, they are severely limited in their physical capacity. But, I mean, look at somebody like Stephen Hawking. I mean, yes, he was a genius. But look what he did with the genius he had. He didn't have to share that with the world. He could have just enjoyed it himself. Probably would have had more time to write if he had spent less time getting his writings out there and telling people about what he was learning. But that wasn't his point. He wanted to share what he learned. He didn't let his limitations become the defining things in his life. And neither need we. And that's something that I get out of this. And it's a beautiful, beautiful message. And you know, as he says, he wondered if this was kind of a purgatory at first, but came to realize it wasn't. It was something that was, he wasn't there to feel good, per se, but he had a mission. There was a reason for his experience. And these kinds of experiences are very powerful because they teach so potently the power of our choices and the importance of our choices. It's true that when you get to the other side, there may not be anyone saying, look how terrible you were. But you will have to face up to the choices that you've made. You will have to see what you've done and decide for yourself, am I grateful for what I've done? Was my life worthwhile? And now, all of us who are listening, every one of you who can hear this, is living in mortality now, which means that you are in the position to make the choice now to do something great with your life. And I'm not talking about, you know, founding, something to end poverty around the world. If you can do that, great, do it. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, you know, maybe you are the person who goes and visits people in the hospital. Maybe you're the one who is kind to your children, even when they frustrate the heck out of you. Maybe you're the one that's the kind person who drops by once in a while just to see how people are doing. That is worth something. In fact, it's worth more than most of the things that we tend to consider to be of great value. Winning an Emmy Award or being on, you know, Netflix television show, world famous, whatever. Those things are fine. There's nothing wrong with any of those things. They're great. They may even be something of a culmination of the years of experience that we have, that we've been working on. But those are not the things that are going to shine in when we look back on this life, when we get to the other side. The things that will shine were the acts of love, the choices that we made that helped someone else in some way, that made them feel worthwhile. Even if only for a few minutes, even if only long enough for them to get through a rough day. That is so, so worth it. So thank you, Jim, for sending that to us. I think a very fascinating experience and very beautiful lesson that we get from that. There is one other message that we got in email that I would like to share, which I think is a really cool one. Anna shares this really cool idea. She says, I'm Anna from Portugal, and I heard you asking for ideas of how to make money with the podcast. I thought that you could create a YouTube channel with Google AdSense. You do so many podcasts, it could be worthwhile. In 2010, I could reach $800 per month with AdSense. Not now, because I don't have time because of my full-time job, but it's very easy. You could put videos with only a landscape or something you like just to maintain you as an anonymous podcaster. Love your podcasts. And then she signs out. Thank you, Anna. What a great idea. You know, I actually opened a YouTube channel when I first started this, but I really didn't end up doing much with it. I think I posted a few videos and then just kind of let it go. But I think I may look into that, because the response that I've seen from the listeners of the podcast has been incredible. I've had more listeners to this podcast than I've had views of probably all my YouTube videos of other efforts outside of this podcast ever did. And I suppose that's probably what discouraged me from YouTube, just because I never really had much success, say with my music and so forth. They get 250 views or something, which is great. I'm happy to have those views, you know. But was it worth the hours I put into making the video? I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. You know. But she makes a great point, and that's that we're having success with the podcast. The podcast has reached thousands of listeners. I think the most recent thing says in the last 60 days, there's been nearly 5,000 hours of listening. In the last 60 days, that's like 80 hours a day of listening between all the listeners that we have. So, you know, if we could get that kind of response on YouTube as well, you're right, Anna. There's no reason that shouldn't be able to at least help to support the podcast. So I love that, and I think I'm going to do something about that. So I really appreciate that. And otherwise, so far what we've got as far as supporting the podcast, we do now have a Patreon account, which is patreon.com/ndecast. There is a link on the website, and the website is neardeathexperiencepodcast.org. If you would like to share your experience as Jim did today, or share a comment or an idea as Anna did, you can email neardeathexperiencepodcast@gmail.com, or you can call 970-NDE-CAST and share your message in 3-minute bits until you get it all shared, and then I can piece it together for the podcast. Thank you, all of you. I so much appreciate your listening. If you feel like sharing a review on iTunes, that would also help people to find the show. But overall, I just want to thank all of you so much again for listening.